Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with mystery novelist Nevada Barr, whose new entry in the Anna Pigeon series is titled Destroyer Angel. We'll also hear from Sally Asher, author of Hope and New Orleans, a history of Crescent City's street names. My guest today is Nevada Barr, who lives in New Orleans but sets her mystery series featuring park ranger Anna Pigeon in national parks all over the country. The last time we spoke was about her novel, The Rope, which was a creepy and amazing mystery. And now she's back with a new entry in the series, Destroyer Angel. Nevada, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you. I am delighted to be here.
Now, the last time we spoke, you said you had put Anna in the worst spot you could think of, at the bottom of a hole. Literally.
Yes.
And in Destroyer Angel, you've put her in another terrible predicament. So what is this new one?
I had decided I wasn't going to write anymore Anna Pigeons. I didn't want any contracts, and I thought I would write all these wonderful things. Turns out I won't write without the carrot and the stick. So I was getting really depressed and couldn't write anything. And my agent called and said, well, why don't you just go back to Anna? And so I thought, okay, this is going to be... I want something straightforward and forceful. You kill everybody, you get to go home. Okay.
Wow. That's about as straightforward as it gets.
And I so much wanted to bring Heath back because she was one of my favorite characters. She was in Hard Truth. And I just loved her. So I was trying to find some way I could factor that in. And then when I went up to Minnesota to do the research, I just met these wonderful women that were with Blue Skies. It's a company that makes equipment so that disabled people can live more comfortably and can go into the backcountry more comfortably. So they just took me and showed me and carried me around, and the book evolved a lot from what they showed me.
It must have been fun to go back to her because she is so smart at the double bind she's in of being dependent on other people and being sympathetic for them. And she's a very complicated, interesting person.
And she'd come so far because when I first met her, she'd just broken her back and become a paraplegic and was bitter and angry and drinking. And then through the first book, she kind of got up to a certain point and had adopted this child. And so it was fun to come back and see her 5 years later and the woman that she had become.
So you have four women and, well, five women with Anna on a girl weekend out in the backwoods. And something terrible happens.
Yes. And I had so much fun. In fact, my friend Julie Smith worked on the book with me when I was hitting hard spots. And she said, after she got into it, she said, you know, you can torture him a little more if you want. So,
what a good invitation.
Exactly. So, because I wanted them all to be real. And I wanted my bad guys to be real and have a genuine purpose for being bad, not just to make the story. But I wanted all of my women to also, even the younger ones, to have weaknesses and strengths and then have this incredible hardship bring out both. So they, you know, they step up to the bar, they fall off the bar, they pick each other up. They, you know, it's just, I wanted it to be real heroism.
Right. The nitty gritty of it.
Yeah.
So not to spoil anything, four men take four women hostage and Anna is the great hope.
Yes, she is doing what she often does, which is go off by herself to contemplate nature when these men take over the camp. And so she is sort of the ghost in the darkness. Mm-hmm. They don't know she exists, and she can't leave. And she has one companion, an old dog that belongs to Heath.
Wiley the dog. It's a great dog story.
You know, Anna always has to have a companion. And usually it's a human being, but in this one, it's a dog because it's not for Anna, it's for me. you know, you got to have some relief there. You can't be all alone. You know, mm-hmm. in the hole, she even got a little skunk. You know?
Oh, goodness. Well, tell about the research you did, because this is set in a different national park.
It's actually not. It's in a national forest,
right.
And it's in the Iron Country in northwestern Minnesota. And I'd spent a lot of time up there as a younger woman in the Boundary Waters and so forth. But I wanted a place that was still very wild and hard to get to and around in. And this part of the country really factors into that because it's cut up with lakes and rivers and matted herbage. And I wanted wolves. And the wolves have come back to Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And we saw one.
Ooh.
In its natural habitat, a big black male. And of course, you saw him where you see all wildlife crossing the road in front of your car.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Even the prospect yeah. of wolves is
oh,
exciting.
Yeah,
you know?
And to hear them, you know, it's just great.
Now, it's very important to you to get people interested in being in the outdoors and really enjoying them. And I can see that Heath has that special place in your heart that you really want everybody to understand that they can do this. And so as she tests out this equipment, are these really under development, these things that make it possible?
Oh, yes. And Blue Skies has actually invented some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And we had our MacGyver chapter, which I worked on with both engineers, Diane and Sherry, sending pictures back and forth where the engineer on the trip for the testing equipment remakes a sports wheelchair into something that can penetrate these thickets. But one of my other inspirations was a friend of Sherry and Diane's, and he's a professional sailor. He teaches sailing on Lake Michigan, so he no slouch, maybe 40, I guess. And he, an accident crippled him when he was 15. And so I met with him, and he would tell me, you know, best way to get around and all these things. He still teaches sailing. He sails, you know, all the time. And you think, that kind of just sensible courage.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted Heath to have that where, like you and I can't lift as much as Arnold Schwarzenegger. We don't lie around and whimper about it, you know, and if you could take every disability just as, well, somebody can do it, you can't, you move on.
Right. And you have women at so many different stages of life in this. You have the two teenage girls who are very, very different. And it seemed important to you to get them into the story as well.
Yes. When I first finished the book, they were not developed. And I didn't like the book. And so I talked about it for a while with Julian. And I went back and I realized I didn't know them. And so I went back and did the work to find out who they were, which is sitting with them, you know, what they were thinking and doing. And that made the book well-rounded because I didn't want them to just be paper dolls. You know, sometimes you even read a book or write a book where one or two of the characters are just there for plot reasons and they, you don't even know who they are. And it was the same with the lead bad guy. I really wanted to know who he was.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's so interesting to me in this book is the way the women are all so strong and resourceful in this setting, and they know how to look around and use what's at their disposal and really read the landscape and the possibilities there. And some of the men, the big and strong men with the weapons, are frankly terrified.
It was so much fun to put Greenhorn City Boys and plop them down in the North Woods. And one of them is basically from the hood. He's come on this adventure, you know, in little black beetle boots and a leather coat, you know. And it was an awful lot of fun to let nature be one of their worst antagonists.
Right. And how much fun is it to see a man in the wrong shoes? Oh. It's a lot of fun.
It is. Try to run in those heels, buddy.
Exactly. And now, one more time, for people who might have missed it before, tell the story of how you got your wonderful name.
Oh, my mother was a pilot, not an airline pilot, but they run a small ma and pa airport. And she was also an airline mechanic, or airplane mechanic. And she had this theory. She wouldn't let guys that were mechanics but didn't fly work on her airplanes because she believed that they wouldn't know the stresses and strains that the machinery was to come under. So when she got pregnant with me, which was now 62 years ago, which was, you know, she didn't want a male OBGYN because she didn't think he'd understand the stresses and strains the machinery was going to be under. So that long ago, it was hard to find a female OBGYN. And she found one in Yerington, Nevada, which was about an hour's airplane flight from our little airport. And so she flew out there every month for a checkup. And then 2 weeks before I was born, she went out and stayed with Dr. Mary on her sheep ranch with her husband. And so after all that, they decided the name would be Nevada.
See, you really can do anything. I mean, you come by it so honestly. We've been talking with Nevada Barr, whose 18th novel in her Anna Pigeon series is Destroyer Angel. You can see her Tuesday, April 1st from 6 to 7:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sally Asher is one of those New Orleanians who loves her hometown. She's lived here since 1994, and she's lived here long enough to be a retired Big Easy roller girl. That's quite an achievement,
I think.
She has a master's degree in English from Tulane, and now she's working on a master's degree in history. Her new book is Hope and New Orleans, A History of Crescent City Street Names, and it is a blast. Sally, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan.
Now, we love our street names in New Orleans, don't we?
Yes, absolutely.
And there is one book that's kind of a classic of New Orleans street names. That's John Chase's Frenchmen Desire Good Children. So what made you think it was time to do a different look at our street names?
Well, that book is definitely a classic, and it's the book that's kind of been held up throughout the ages. But if you go back through history, newspapers started writing about our street names during the 1840s and 1850s, and other newspapers across the country were commenting on the unusual, whimsical qualities of New Orleans street names. And they originally started basically in the 1920s with Stanley Clisby Arthur, who started writing about the street names. And the Times-Picayune in the 1930s did various articles that were a huge success, a weekly installment on the history of our street names. But it's definitely John Churchill Chase who put it on the map. But as wonderful and delightful as the book is, it was written in the 1940s. And it can be fairly outdated, and there have been new streets that have been named. And this one comes with photographs as well.
Oh, I know, which is really nice. And it's not just the names of the streets, it's our hilarious pronunciations too, isn't it?
That still baffles me to this day. I sometimes have a hard enough time speaking correct pronunciation. So when there's various interpretations that you can kind of find out where someone lives of how they pronounce something, it can be very confusing.
I know. It cracks me up. I mean, my own street has different pronunciations sometimes. Now, I'm curious, do you think that we feel differently about our streets because we use them in different ways? I mean, we have parades, we have second lines. I have seen you roller skating down
Yes.
our streets. So how do you feel about that kind of relationship we have?
I think automatically, sometimes when people say street names, for example, Bourbon Street or St. Charles Avenue, it automatically elicits either some kind of emotional response or you have some image of it. And New Orleanians tend to take very much pride on where they live in and seem to want to work their way up to specific streets. And even streets back in the olden days would automatically, like Basin Street, for example, if you mentioned you were going down to Basin Street, you knew what kind of women and liquor and gambling you were going to be encountering. And New Orleanians, they seem to take pride because our history is written in the streets. And almost nowhere else in the United States is that true. But I think what makes New Orleans so special is, good or bad, we don't really have a filter. We tend to celebrate both. There are some streets, upon investigation, I had to kind of question myself, why did we name a street after this terrible, awful person who not only history shows might not have been the best person, but during that time the street was named, they were well-known scoundrels or they committed treason. Yet we still name a street after them mm-hmm. because they somehow made a mark in New Orleans.
Exactly. Well, one of the things that fascinates me is that some of our streets are world famous.
Yes.
Like St. Charles Avenue, Bourbon Street, Canal Street. Don't you find that interesting?
I was thinking about that, thinking what other streets in the United States kind of evoke that. And there's Broadway, maybe in New York. And I would say the Strip in Las Vegas and Rodeo Drive. Other than that, I don't really think there's that many other cities that you know the street names to if you're not from there.
Right.
And evoke some kind of response. Oh, you have to shop on Magazine Street. You have to take the streetcar in St. Charles. You have to go to Bourbon Street when you visit New Orleans. And other streets don't have that kind of passion attached to their street names.
I mean, Bourbon Street has its own biography now by Richard Campanella, which I think is really kind of wonderful, don't you?
I am so excited to read it. I'm very excited. I just got my copy last week, the day it came out. And it's funny, when I was investigating Bourbon Street, it was the first street that I started to write about. And I think I did it because it was my least favorite street at the time, as Richard was talking how he grapples with the love-hate relationship between Bourbon Street. And since it was my first street, I went way overboard and ended up actually writing 30 pages on it, which only got me to about 4 or 5 decades of the street. And when I was writing, I thought, how come no one's ever written a book about Bourbon Street? It's amazing, the transformation. Mm-hmm. And then a few months later, I found that Richard had written one. I was so excited to read about it. And the transformation on, it's very ironic and funny that it's named after, you know, a royal house. But, you know, definitely nowadays.
Look at what it is.
Yeah,
yes.
Look at what it is and what it's become. I do believe it was, for a time period, battling Canal Street. It seemed like it could go either way.
Right.
Either Canal or Bourbon Street was going to kind of take up the flag of debauchery. And Bourbon Street won.
Yep. Firmly planted, I
guess. I don't think it's going anywhere now.
Now, one of the things that's so much fun about this book, and this speaks to the need for updating, you know, Frenchmen Desire Good Children and taking a look at our streets now, is one particularly famous feud that unfolded on St. Charles Avenue.
Oh, yes. When writing about St. Charles Avenue, and I had to keep my word count in mind, which I think is difficult for any writer, you know, how do you sum up St. Charles Avenue? You have the streetcars and you have the mansions and the giant stately oak trees. And I thought, well, how can I tell a story, a proper story, to give credit to this street? And I remember it was when I first moved here. I'd only been living here for a few years and witnessed the Al Copeland and Rice feud that took place on St. Charles Avenue. And it just spoke to me about, I don't want to say new money, old money, but basically the kind of gothic, romantic New Orleans versus the new flashy New Orleans, and how Al Copeland wore ostrich boots and drove Ferraris, and, you know, Anne Rice is all dressed in black and lace and showing up for book signings and coffins. And the battle over St. Charles, as an outsider who at the time thought that she knew New Orleans but didn't, it was fascinating to watch. And just the transformation of the street and how strongly people felt about it. Most people, I think, thought it was hysterical, as rightfully so. But it does say something about how New Orleanians tend to cling to their traditions and their past. And right. We don't want anything new coming along.
And they'll take ownership.
They'll take, exactly. They'll take ownership on it.
So one of the most charming, charming things about this book is the way the chapters are organized thematically, which is so charming and must have made it fun to write. So tell us about some of these unusual groupings.
Well, if you actually study the history of the streets, you kind of begin to see patterns in it. There's Plantation Belles, there's politicians, there's pirates, there's philanthropists, and they all tend to be grouped in different areas. The Plantation Belles, the chapter 3, Exquisite Nepotism, Plantation Belles and the Landowners Who Love Them, was probably the most difficult chapter to write. Going back through the archives and the history, names are spelled differently. You'll have 6 different scholars spell a name a different way. The newspapers, the deeds, the obituaries all tell names slightly different. But the one that I probably had the most fun writing, which I didn't think I would at the time, was the Glorious Fighters, the military heroes and the civic leaders. When it came to people who lived outside of New Orleans, national and international figures that we've honored with streets, particularly after World War I, we named a lot of streets after generals. I wanted to tell the story of what they meant to New Orleans and what their impact on New Orleans was. And it was fascinating finding these generals were going on these giant world tours all over the country. And when they came into town, it was rock star pandemonium, like boy band crazy. And people would come by the thousands and hang off of trees and stand on ladders and jump on their cars just to try and get close to the military leaders. And it was interesting how still New Orleans took something that didn't necessarily belong to them and made them their own. And so in writing about past presidents or military leaders or even civic leaders like Martin Luther King, what did they mean to New Orleans and how did we embrace them and what's their own story here? And that was probably the most fun to write.
Oh, and history buffs are going to love, love that chapter. Now, one of the great things that you do is you have an index. So people can look up their streets. And it's so, I can just imagine everybody grabbing this book and turning to the index. And I was very happy to see my own street.
That's good. I'm terrified to get my first question of, why did you not include my street?
Of course.
Why did you not include this one? And
well, mine is DeFawcett Street. And you tell a classic joke about DeFawcett Street.
Yes. It's, why can't you water the lawns at the library? Because you can't turn on DeFawcett, because it's a very odd one-way street.
It is,
that
one
goes
way partly.
That's another thing. I think it's half of 1% of the street names in New Orleans are numbered. And it's that high because there's a smattering of streets in Lakeview, numbered streets in Lakeview. But the ones in New Orleans, there was a movement around the 1800s, right after we changed Fifth Street to Washington Street, to rename First and Fourth and Sixth through Ninth. And Swords, who was the head of the city directory, argued that First Street was in no means first in any way whatsoever, and that it just randomly broke up since there was no Fifth Street. And he wanted to name the streets Crown, King, Queen, Prince, which was turned down, which is funny because nowadays people on Sixth Street would be living on Princess Street if that was the case, which I actually would prefer. Mm-hmm. Which would be fun. But since there's so many streets and they all have their own history and their own story behind them, it was really difficult narrowing it down to roughly 375 streets.
Well, that's a good number. Now, if you were going to have the pleasure of naming a street in New Orleans, what are some of the names that would appeal to you?
Josie Arlington Street would be fun. Probably not politically correct. I think Myra Clark should definitely get her own street. I would love to drive down or live on maybe Big Chief Tootie Montana Street would be great.
I like that.
Some kind of marker on him would be fabulous. But I think if I had to choose just one, it'd be Louis Armstrong. Louis Armstrong Avenue or Satchmo Street, I think would be fabulous.
Or Satchmo Place.
Satchmo Place.
Wouldn't that be nice?
It all has a nice ring to it.
It does.
Just like Louis.
I know.
Just like Louis.
That sounds great.
All has a nice ring to it.
We've been talking with Sally Asher, whose wonderful new book is Hope and New Orleans, A History of Crescent City Street Names. You can meet her Wednesday, March 26th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Sally, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
My husband used to come by the bookstore where I worked every day, and that's pretty much where we fell in love. That's what Harrison Hudson sings about in Bookstore Girl.
My heart's collecting dust up on a shelf. It sits there waiting, oh, for you to pick it up in your hands and read it two or three times. Oh, I'm trying really hard to read you, Bookstore Girl. Oh, baby, let your hair down low. Let your hair down. between the lines behind so many covers. They're blown. You're looking for the end that you read so many lonely nights. Oh, let me check you out. Oh, please don't make it hard to read you. Bookstore girl, oh baby, let your hair down low. Let your hair down, bookstore girl, oh baby, let your hair down.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes sign HRC, State Secrets and the Rebirth of Hillary Clinton, Tuesday, March 25th at 6 at Octavia Books. Today's guest, Sally Asher, signs Hope and New Orleans, A History of Crescent City Street Names, Wednesday, March 26th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Andre Knapp signs Find Momo, My Dog is Hiding in This Book, Can You Find Him? Friday, March 28th at 6 at Octavia Books. C.S. Harris signs Why Kings Confess, Saturday, March 29th at 1 at Garden District Bookshop. John Gary signs his new poetry collection, Have At You Now, Sunday, March 30th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar, followed by an open mic. Today's guest, Nevada Barr, signs Destroyer Angel, Tuesday, April 1st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Don't forget, the Friends of the Jefferson Public Library will conduct their semi-annual Big Book Sale, Thursday, April 10th to Sunday, April 13th at the Pontchartrain Center. Hours are 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. Thursday through Saturday, April 10th through 12th, and noon to 5, Sunday, April 13th. In other news, congratulations are due the winners of the National Book Critics Circle Awards. Novelist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie for her book Americana. Poet Frank Bidart for Metaphysical Dog. Critic Franco Moretti for Distant Reading. Amy Willens won the Autobiography Award for Farewell Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. Sherry Fink won the Nonfiction Award for 5 Days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital. Leo Damrosch won the Biography Award for Jonathan Swift, His Life and His World. Novelist Anthony Mara won the John Leonard Prize for his A Constellation of Vital Phenomena. The recipient of the Ivan Sandroff Lifetime Achievement Award, 84-year-old Rolando Hinojosa, was recognized for putting Mexican-American literature on the cultural map. Catherine Powers, who writes for the Barnes & Noble Review, won the Nona Balakian Citation for Excellence in Reviewing. For all of you Vampire Lestat fans out there, the wait is coming to an end. Novelist Anne Rice announced that famous vampire will be returning in a new novel, Prince Lestat, to be published October 28, 2014. And it's time to start planning your entry for the Edible Book Art event at the New Orleans Museum of Art, April 4th. Think about transforming your favorite book into artful cake form. Email Sheila Cork, that's scork at noma.org, by March 29th to register. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.